I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. I am joined today by a co-host, David Suddy, who is an attorney. And our guest is Jason Van Dyke, who is also an attorney, an attorney from Texas. Jason, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Greg. I appreciate the invitation to come on the stream.
Jason came to my attention because he has defended people who could be broadly called dissident right people, certainly dissidents. And I wanted to learn more about his work and some of the challenges that he's faced by taking on these controversial cases. If you Google his name, you'll see him called a Proud Boys lawyer or a Patriot Front lawyer. I don't know if that's even ethical. Do most lawyers who do criminal defense, do they get characterized in the press as murderer lawyer or rapist lawyer? But you're being labeled in connection with these dissident right groups. And I just think it's important to find out what are the challenges you face. And before we do that, though, could you tell us just a bit about yourself, how you came to be involved in the law, where you practice and so forth?
Certainly, Greg. Thank you for asking. I was born and raised in Troy, Michigan. I graduated from Lutheran High School Northwest in 1998. That's in Rochester Hills, Michigan. And I also then I went to Michigan State for a little while. Wasn't a good fit. I ended up transferring to University of Dallas. That's how I got to Texas. I got my BA there in 03. And then I immediately matriculated to Stetson University College of Law. That's in Gulfport, Florida. For those who don't know where that is, it's in the St. Petersburg area. I was able to finding loopholes. I found a loophole that let me take the Texas bar exam before I actually graduated from law school. So the summer before my last semester, I was a spring entrant. I passed the Texas bar exam, went back for another semester where I was mostly doing internships and just work on the side. I graduated, moved right back to Texas. I really got my start in doing commercial debt collection law. I mean, the economy was pretty good at the time. Jobs for new attorneys were scarce. But I always wanted to do criminal law. And since that time, while I still have a large commercial debt collection practice, that's an area of law I've always done very well. The criminal defense has greatly expanded. Now criminal defense is about over half of what I do. I'm a partner at a law firm called Magani & Van Dyke. We're in Denton, Texas. We do criminal defense, family law, and commercial debt collection. And my practice, I also have part of it devoted to what I just call broadly First Amendment law. So myself and Jenna, my partner, we've been doing this for quite a long time. I've been practicing law for 17 years now. I love doing the criminal stuff. I've always thought that's the most fun. You really get to help people, but I still like doing the debt collection law, helping small businesses collect money that's owed to them. But I mean, really for me, the most rewarding work is the First Amendment type of stuff, which is what drew me to representing what is called the dissident right, because it's been my observation over the years that it's these groups who are most likely to have their First Amendment rights impinged upon. So that's a little bit about what I do.
That's great. What are some of the more high profile cases that you've taken on that deal with First Amendment issues?
Well, the first and the highest profile one was in 2013. I'm not going to disclose the name of my client in that case because due to the nature of the case, I really got started and some people saw me as an enemy of the First Amendment in this. It was a revenge pornography case. There's a really good documentary about what revenge pornography is. It's on Netflix. It has my friend James McGibney in it, and it's about this scourge that was on the internet. What people were doing was they were sometimes in the context of relationships, people share naughty pictures of each other. Well, obviously breakups occur And people would then take the naughty pictures that they got and post them on the internet for revenge, hence it being called revenge pornography. Well, anyway, we got this revenge porn website shut down. So that was kind of my first entrance into the whole First Amendment law thing. Then come 2017, of course, Donald Trump had won the 2016 election. I had some issues in my life. I didn't make the greatest decision when I joined a little-known group at the time called the Proud Boys, and I ended up representing the Proud Boys from about summer of 2017 until November of 2018. And what we were really trying to do there was trying to get these mainstream media outlets to quit saying stuff about the Proud Boys, which was completely untrue. I mean, at least it was at the time. I've not been involved in many years. But they were saying that this was a Nazi group, this was a white supremacist group, and we were trying to protect their rights and to essentially exist on social media and not be defamed by these leftist groups and these leftist publications. I mean, there was like the Huffington Post and the Daily Beast, those, you know, the usual suspects. Those were the worst offenders. And we were really working hard on that. And I still believe the Proud Boys was essentially dead going into 2019 as a viable group. It was killed by just ongoing defamation by the left. I think I think the concept behind the Proud Boys was a great thing. I've got no quarrel with Gavin McInnes. I think he gave the dissident right a group that at the time was certainly needed. I think he made some mistakes, but I certainly felt Gavin's heart was in the right place. I was out of the game for a little while. There was a lot of fallout from my representation of the Proud Boys. I'm not going to talk about this case here, but I was stalked by a madman for a number of years, and I wasn't even practicing law for a bit, but I came back and to practicing law shortly, right towards the end of the pandemic. I joined the Marsala Law Group in 2021, and that's where I started focusing on criminal defense. But, you know, even though I don't have anything really good to say about the Proud Boys anymore, I really did miss the kind of work I did for them. And what I noticed was there were other groups out there that needed help. I looked at a lot of them, and they were broad, but the ones that were really at the tip of the spear was Patriot Front. And so I reached out to them to see if they needed my assistance, and boy, did they ever. They had another attorney working with them. He was going through some personal issues, and they're all resolved. He's doing great. He's a friend of mine. We still chat every now and then. And I essentially took over where he left off and helped members of their group, whether it was criminal defense stuff, business startups. I've helped them in all manner of things, but it was really pretty recently that we started getting into the litigation side because of organizations, and they call themselves law firms. I call them virtue signaling firms that have taken it upon themselves to sue Patriot Front. And most of these lawsuits are completely frivolous, and I'm helping where I can.
That's great. What are some of the current Patriot Front related things that you're involved in? Can you speak about any of these? I heard recently that Thomas Rousseau got arrested for carrying a tiki torch back in 2016. Are there some of these things that you can actually speak about?
I have limited involvement in Mr. Rousseau's case. Obviously, I'm a Texas attorney, and this tiki torch nonsense of a case is happening in Virginia. I got word that Mr. Rousseau had been picked up by the West Police Department in McLennan County. Obviously, I was concerned for my client. He had been a client for some time. I drove to McLennan County, did what I did, met with him at the jail, made sure he understood about what was likely to happen as far as extradition was concerned. And we immediately went to work. I know the organization was able to raise a lot of money. They did a great job and made my life easier. And then my job, I worked that weekend on a motion to secure Mr. Rousseau's release, had it e-filed a few days after his arrest, before even the following Monday. Monday morning, I called the court. We got a hearing that Thursday. The judge made a very wise and fair decision, granted Mr. Rousseau an extradition bond, and those are not easy to get. A lot of judges don't care for those. But Mr. Rousseau has no criminal history, no history of flight. It was a high bond, but we got it posted. We secured Mr. Rousseau's release with a cash bond in Texas. And like I said, he doesn't run. He's never run from anything, from what I can see. And the week after he was released, like he got out on a Thursday night and he was in Virginia that Monday to turn himself in. And he was granted a PR bond, it's my understanding, by the court in Virginia. So he's free on bond on this Tiki Torch case. That's going to end my involvement with it. I've been doing what I can to help him secure legal counsel in Virginia to fight these charges. I think they're ridiculous. I think there's some real due process issues that are going to be a problem for the state in bringing these charges. But I'm not licensed there, so I did everything I could for him in Texas. So now that we're getting the bond money back and the ball is rolling in Virginia, it's in their court. I've talked to some of the lawyers in Virginia, and I'm very confident in their ability.
Yeah, David, do you have any questions for Jason?
Yes,
yeah.
I do. So I heard you were recently involved in a case in North Dakota. Can you speak about that at all?
Yes, absolutely. The case in North Dakota is one of three very similar lawsuits pending in federal court right now. When I heard about it, I made sure to get admitted to the district court in North Dakota because I didn't know if they were going to hire me for this case, but I wanted it because there had previously been a lawsuit filed against the group and some of its members in Virginia. And then there had also been a lawsuit filed against the group and some of its members in Massachusetts. Now, what a lot of people don't know is when people talk about attorneys getting licensed, the licenses that are pretty tough to get are the state court level licenses. Like I'm licensed in Texas, Colorado, and Georgia. And another one that's hard to get is Washington, D.C. I'm licensed in the District of Columbia. But federal courts have their own licensing requirements. And like, for example, in the Virginia federal courts and the Massachusetts federal courts, you have to be a member of the bar of that state in order to be a member of the bar of those federal courts. North Dakota has no such requirement. So being a member in good standing of the bar in Texas, and I mean, I've admitted to a number of other federal courts as well. It was just a matter of filling out an application and paying a fee to get admitted to the District of North Dakota so that I would be able to represent them. The North Dakota case specifically, what's alleged to have happened is supposedly a number of Patriot Front members at the urging of my two clients spray painted the patriotfront.us on the building and on an art mural that was attached to the building. And now, this is, of course, I'm only representing Mr. Rousseau and a person who's not even a member of Patriot Front. He's a former member and was not a member and had no involvement at the time this occurred. So they got their information from anti-fascists. I'm going to, if it goes to discovery, which I'm sure at least part of the case will, I'm going to find out where they got their source because it's Thomas Rousseau and Trevor Velasco who I'm representing. Mr. Velasco was not in Patriot Front at the time this occurred and hadn't been for a year. So my guess is they inferred his involvement through information that was stolen from Patriot Front by Unicorn Riot when the Unicorn Riot hacked their servers. Mr. Rousseau's role is he supposedly authorized and encouraged the destruction of this mural. And the truth is that Mr. Rousseau did absolutely no such thing. When he found out about this lawsuit and read the complaint, he was surprised about it as anybody because he would not have authorized something like that, and he did not authorize something like that. And if the Patriot Front chapter in North Dakota had asked his permission to vandalize a mural like that, it would have been denied. And had he known who, if it would, we don't even know if it was members of Patriot Front that vandalized that mural, but had it been, he assures me they would have been removed from the organization. So that's the factual, the supposed factual basis for the lawsuit. I believe Mr. Rousseau. I believe Mr. Velasquez. So the other side has their facts totally wrong. But where we're at right now is we've filed what's called a motion to dismiss under Rule 12b-6 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. And I'll explain to your listeners, basically what we're alleging is that even if everything they've said in their complaint is true, that they still lose. And here's some of the basis for that. First of all, and it, please interrupt me if you want me to clarify something. There are three plaintiffs in this lawsuit. One of them is called the North Dakota Human Rights Coalition, I believe. The second one is the Immigrant Development Center. And the third one, I know who it really is, but I'm under court order. I can only refer to her as Plaintiff Doe for right now. Okay. First of all, North Dakota Human Rights Coalition thinks that they have a case here because they're saying that after this happened, that they used their own resources to help with cleanup and that those resources could have been better spent writing grant applications and things like that. Well, I'm sorry, but that's horse shit. They don't have standing to sue. What they're trying to argue here is that their own willful diversion of resources in response to the destruction of this mural, whoever committed it, gives them standing in federal court. And that does not meet federal standing requirements. If that were true, I could just go wait for an oil spill to happen, go help clean up in the oil spill, and then have a cause of action against the oil company because I chose to go help clean up this oil spill. But that wouldn't be lawful or reasonable. So I'm confident we're going to win our standing argument with respect to the coalition, I think. And then the other thing they've done is they've brought claims under the Ku Klux Klan Act. And this is where we're getting into something that's very, very dangerous for the First Amendment. I'm working to knock out the claims under the Ku Klux Klan Act because this law has been the favorite toy of the leftist lawyer and virtue signaler at law for years now. It really started during the 2020 election. It really came to a head after January 6th. Make no mistake, what these law firms and these lawyers are trying to do is use the Ku Klux Klan Act to establish something that doesn't exist, and that is no more or less than a hate speech exception to the First Amendment. And that's been litigated before, and it has been rejected by the Supreme Court. I think the last time it was 9-0, they rejected the notion of a hate speech exception to the First Amendment. And so that's where our focus is. We don't believe the Human Rights Coalition has standing. We don't believe Plaintiff Doe has any standing. Our position is that the only person involved in this lawsuit that has suffered any possible injury here is the owner of the artwork, which is the Immigrant Development Center. And we're not arguing. My clients aren't responsible for it. They had nothing to do with it. But assuming that what they're saying in their petition is true, those are the only claims that really should exist in this lawsuit. And that would normally be a state court claim, but they're using the Ku Klux Klan Act to bring these, what would otherwise be state law conversion claims, into federal court. And that's wrong. And I'm very hopeful that the court will see that they're trying to use the Ku Klux Klan Act and the other civil rights acts to create federal claims where none exist.
Right. So one of my favorite sayings, and a lot of people use it on the right, is that the purpose of a system is what it does. And it seems like the Klan Act, whatever nonsense, it's always used to shut down white speech. It never has been used against anybody else. And it really does seem like a viewpoint thing. It's just a club. And so I know you do a lot of defense, but I've been kicking around the idea, and this is easier said than done, but going on the offense, because from what I understand from, you know, law school and all that, mostly is that you can have standing for to sue if you have to give up doing something you like to do. And you can say, well, the statute prohibits it, or I think the statute could be used against me. And so I was wondering if somebody could basically, instead of waiting until getting into trouble, go on the offense against this act or other acts and try to get this up to the Supreme Court, or perhaps appeal from the ongoing Charlottesville fiasco. Because the Supreme Court has been all over the place with their decisions, but they do seem to be, as they say online, a little bit based recently. So I'm wondering if we could get the Supreme Court to decisively smack this down. Is that possible? And would that be helpful?
Yes, I think that, frankly, part of the reason I wanted to get this case is because I think it has the potential to go to the Supreme Court, and I'm going to explain why. The plaintiff's theory of the case is that they suffered injury under the Ku Klux Klan Act because they, for two reasons. One, they're saying that this graffiti impeded their ability to contract or impeded their rights to contract in the same way that white people do. I addressed that in my 12b-6 and my reply to their response. It's absurd. No contracts have been breached due to this vandalism, whoever did it. And furthermore, they have not and cannot meet the elements of tortious interference to the extent necessary to prove a claim under 42 USC section 1981. So they shouldn't have a basis there. But
that's pretty, if you don't mind me interjecting real quick, I think it's pretty rich that they're saying tortious interference in a contract, because that's the whole point of doxing, is to tortiously interfere in our contracts with employment. So it's, you know, accuse your enemy of what you yourself do. It's kind of funny there. And two, just for another quick point, is damages can't be you can't just say, well, this person was mean in law. For our listeners here, you have to prove damages. They can't be illusory or vapid. They have to be, show me the broken leg. And you can prove financial damages different ways, but it can't just be, well, this person was bad, it did bad things. There needs to be actual damages that can reasonably be established.
Yeah, and I don't see how they're going to do that here. I know their theory of the case is that they were the landlord, and that this International Market Plaza suffered a decrease in business, and that as the landlord and microlender, it harmed their contracts. I don't think that, even if it is true, I don't think that gets them there under a tortious interference theory, because for tortious interference, the contract has to be breached, and they're not even alleging breach. So I think they've got a problem there. But really, I've actually advocated using tortious interference against anti-fascists for a number of years. There's a guy, I believe his name is Daryl Lamont Jenkins, who he runs some, it was called the One People's Project. It might be called IDAVOX now. I don't know what he's doing, but I don't care about him. But he would call up venues and try to get in, like, someone like Jared Taylor or someone else who was going to have a perfectly peaceful speech when they were going to speak, and get venues to shut down the speech. And I've said, you know, we need to start suing anti-fascists who tortiously interfere with our contracts with venues, and where we have to have contracts, and we need to start filing suit for this stuff. So that is something where I think people who are being targeted by anti-fascists, where they have a remedy. But I don't think they would have one under 42 USC section 1981, because it would have to be some type of race-based thing. And I don't necessarily believe that anti-fascists are doing this because they're anti-white. That might be part of the motivation. I think they're doing it because they don't actually believe in the First Amendment. These are people who they claim to be the anti-fascists, but they're the ones that want to shut down speech, take away the right to bear arms, and force everybody to conform to their idea of what America should be. So, I mean, they're more fascist than anyone I've ever met on the dissident right. But really, David, it's the second part of what they're saying in this lawsuit that should raise the alarm of the listeners, because they're saying that they have a claim because they experienced fear or intimidation on account of race in a place of public accommodation, which is this International Market Plaza. Now, I want you to think about that for a minute. I mean, first of all, feelings of fear or intimidation are entirely subjective. And they're expecting this court to believe that they felt that because a URL was spray painted over artwork. Now, I'm not saying that they shouldn't have had, that the artwork should have been vandalized. Vandalism is illegal, and we all know that. We understand that. But they're alleging that these feelings of fear from that, I mean, plaintiff, no, it wasn't even her artwork. It was the Immigrant Development Center's artwork. It wasn't even her artwork, that she experienced this, and that even though she is the executive director of this Immigrant Development Center, that she didn't use the international marketplace as much. Well, let's follow Plaintiff Doe's argument to its ultimate and idiotic conclusion. If a person has a claim in federal court under the Ku Klux Klan Act, anytime they've experienced feelings of fear or intimidation on account of race in any place of public accommodation, well, what that does is it establishes exactly what the Supreme Court has prohibited, which is a hate speech exception to the First Amendment. Because everyone knows, I'm not a big fan of the Ku Klux Klan, but everyone knows the Ku Klux Klan, if they wanted to, could march in front of the courthouse in my town of Decatur, Texas, and they could not be stopped. They could say what they want. But under plaintiff's theory of the case, if anyone saw that and became afraid or intimidated by that, they all of a sudden have a federal claim against a group that did nothing other than exercise their First Amendment rights, however offensive that exercise may have been. And that's wrong, and that's what I'm fighting against. And I think that's something that the Supreme Court's going to have to clarify, that the Ku Klux Klan doesn't establish an exception to the First Amendment for stuff like this, and that these lawyers in these other states, and maybe we haven't had rulings in Virginia or Massachusetts, but I don't expect things to go well in those circuits, given who the political affiliation of those who make up the bench there. But this is an act that has to be reined in. This is not something that the federal courts can or should grant relief to.
Right. And two, it only goes one direction. I could mention numerous times where white people probably have felt fear and intimidation on the basis of race in a place of public accommodation, you know, in a bad neighborhood or at a BLM rally that goes past their house. They would never be allowed to sue under this. This would be struck down. And regardless of what the law says in theory, I'm more concerned about the fact and reality. We all know this is a one-way street here.
I would agree with you that if BLM came and marched down someone's street and they were to sue over that, that lawsuit wouldn't see the light of day. And frankly, I don't think any lawyers would take it. I mean, I wouldn't even take a case like that just because I would know that it's a frivolous use of the act. But ultimately, I think these lawyers on the other side, they're not actually seeking judgments that they can collect on. That's not their goal here. Their goal is to change legal precedent. And as you've pointed out, I mean, if one person has a claim like that, so must everybody else. That's the essence of equal protection. They might not like what happens if their argument wins the day. I don't think it will though. But yeah, if there was a Black Panther rally and they were, or you had some crazy folks yelling death to white people or something like that in a place of public accommodation, we all know darn well a federal judge is going to strike that under 12b-6. He's going to say this is clearly First Amendment protected speech. You don't have to like it, but yeah, I mean, if all they're doing is running their mouths, it's protected. they've got a little bit better case here in North Dakota because the manner in which this speech was done was through an illicit act of vandalism. But they're not saying that it was the act that intimidated them. They're saying they are explicitly stating that they went to the Patriot Front website and they were intimidated based on the content of the website. That's what they've pled in their complaint. So that's what we're going with.
I swear, if I ever take power, I'm going to completely rewrite tort law because there's way too much. Just outside of the political stuff we've discussed, I think there's this too much indulgence of emotional distress. And this stuff should simply be laughed out of court. I'm not a hardcore old English common law type of guy, but I think we need to inch a little bit more back to that where it's all factual and not made up subjective feelings. I don't consider feelings to be real, to be honest, in the legal sense. That's just me. I have a very, very, I guess, traditional view of this.
I've got a better idea, David. When you take power, how about you bring back dueling? I think if we brought back dueling, there'd be a lot less people feeling offended about frivolous things in this society.
Yeah,
I think people would be a lot politer, too.
Yes. And you know what? I think some nice dueling scars are probably less painful than attorney's fees. I'd much rather bleed a little bit of blood than thousands of dollars in cash in attorney's fees. I think most people would, too.
That's a good point. Could I raise a question, Jason, about you've mentioned Antifa a couple of times. So this is a civil trial in North Dakota. And
yeah, that's correct.
Okay. Yeah. Are there criminal cases that are being brought by attorneys, state attorneys, against people on the dissident right based upon information gathered, oftentimes illegally, by Antifa? And is there anything legally problematic about that behavior?
Before you answer, do you think there's an authentication problem with it too?
Yes, that's what I was going to say. I'm not aware off the top of my head of cases being brought based on information provided by Antifa. There's no doubt in my mind that they exist. And that the basis for these cases is illegally obtained information. I know that I'm not sure what's going on. I know some of the Patriot Front guys, I'm not involved in the lawsuit, are suing a guy who claims to have hacked them up in Washington. I don't know the status of that lawsuit. I've got no involvement of it. But from the criminal perspective, yes, I think in many instances, the state is going to have a hard time authenticating some of that evidence, because if I was defending a case like that, I mean, we look at how the technology's come as far as AI goes. I mean, we've heard of deep fakes and stuff like that. It's the state's burden to demonstrate that evidence is, in fact, what they say it is. And if they're getting it from anti-fascists, there couldn't be a more biased or less credible source for that evidence. And if they're not doing anything to independently confirm it, that's certainly something that at trial I would raise for the jury. And I would, in my cross-examinations of the officers and the investigators, I would definitely say, where did you get this information? Okay, how did you determine that these people were credible? Are they here today? And I would even try to find the hacker and call him and get him to admit to doing the hacking under oath so that the groups that got hacked could sue him afterwards. I mean, they can be sued for that. If they admit under oath that they accessed a computer system without authorization and stole information, yeah, that person could absolutely be sued for that. But in Antifa, I know, they don't like to cooperate with law enforcement. They're very anti-cop. And so if they were subpoenaed to testify about how they got this stuff, my guess is they wouldn't honor the subpoena, and the state would have problems because of that, because one of the witnesses that they need to sponsor their evidence isn't going to come to court.
Right. I see another huge issue here, which is the doctrine of the fruit of the poison tree, where, for our listeners, that basically means that the government can't use illegally obtained evidence, but there's a bunch of holes in this and exceptions and rules. And a huge problem here, like this would be, say, the government can't hack Patriot Front. Well, here's a problem. Well, Antifa will hack them or other people, and they did the dirty deed. Well, they're not the government. And so I think this there needs to eventually be case law developed, either after we quote win or maybe the Supreme Court in the meantime, to really say that all these little dirty deeds, you can't obtain this illegally. Whether this is the government or the government's friends in Antifa. Like, there is a very strong, I know you said Antifa doesn't like law enforcement. Well, Antifa and the FBI seem to be working together pretty closely, especially on the J6 stuff. And I'll just say this, the whole idea that you can, the doctrine of the fruit of the poison tree needs to be expanded to be also random third-party actors who are doing this wink-wink, nudge-nudge thing with the government. You can't outsource your narco-tyranny to random, you know, meth heads. Because they're more dangerous, because they're actually better at this than the Alphabet Boys, probably.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. There needs to be some updates to the law on this, because if I've always said, what would happen if it was Elon Musk? That some of this evidence that they're using in these civil cases was apparently obtained from this unicorn riot. It was a hack. They obtained access to a computer system illegally. The people working for Unicorn Riot broke the law. They're criminals. And now the stuff that they took is being used in these civil cases and probably has been used in some criminal cases. Well, if the government had done that, the evidence would be suppressed. So, and right now, what the prevailing argument is the rule of exclusion is designed to stop from government misconduct, not private misconduct. Well, like you said, we don't know what kind of wink, wink, nudge, nudge stuff is going on behind the scenes there. And what would happen if they had hacked Elon Musk? If they'd have broken in to Tesla's systems or X's systems, stolen a bunch of data, and released it so as to harm one of Elon Musk's businesses, they'd go to jail for that. That's a crime. And someone would certainly be prosecuted for doing that. I don't understand why no one's prosecuting Unicorn Riot. I mean, they're saying, oh, this is journalism. Well, claiming to be a journalist doesn't give you the right to commit crimes.
So one thing that I noticed recently is there was a dox of Stone Toss, a fellow Texan, Stone Toss, and you tweeted out that you would be willing to help him deal with Antifa if he's open to that. You don't have to comment on his particular case, but have you helped people who've been doxed by Antifa, or do you know of other lawyers who are doing things like that to try and impede the chaos and harm that's done by doxing, which is the whole purpose of it, after all? They're trying to hurt people because they disagree with their politics.
Yeah, there is what I can do to help people like that is relatively limited. And there's a whole lot of strategy involved. Okay. I've not heard from Stone Toss. I put stuff on my Twitter to kind of let just people within the dissident right know that I'm out there, I'm available for work a lot of times. But it's one thing for them to say, oh, we found out who this guy was through open source material, and here's who this guy is. But there have been instances where you have anti-fascists showing up to people's houses, showing up to their places of business, calling and harassing their landlords, bothering them at school and stuff like that. We have a word for that in Texas. It's called stalking. And when it gets when it gets to that level, I think that it used to happen quite a bit. I do think that the anti-fascists have gotten a little bit more disciplined because they know lawyers like me are out there, and we're going to find out who they are, and we're going to get restraining orders against them. And they're gonna get into some trouble there, but restraining orders is one thing. There's a provision under the Code of Criminal Procedure where that's actually a pretty low standard. I can get an anti-stalking restraining order against anti-fascists if they were just doing stuff that was really beyond the pale here. But what we really need, and I've advocated for this for years, is a lot of people say they believe in free speech, but their actions don't show that. The quickest way to neuter Antifa, and to the extent they're not literally neutered already, I don't think a lot of these guys have balls. That's why they stay behind a keyboard. But the way to neuter Antifa would be if we were to have a law saying that it will be that it is illegal in this country for a public or private employer to reduce, terminate, or otherwise take action against someone's employment based upon that person's lawful exercise of any right under the Constitution off company property and outside of work hours.
That would be huge. Yeah. That would be huge.
That's all we would have to do. And people are saying, oh, well, that impinges upon the employer's First Amendment rights. And I'm sure it would go to the Supreme Court and there'd be a balancing test. But the purpose of this, it's a type of law. We have to understand on the right that it would protect everybody. I mean, if a woman lived in a state where there was a right to abortion, it would presumably be illegal to fire her for having an abortion in a state where that right still exists. If someone like me, I wouldn't do this anyway, but if one of my employees voted for Joe Biden in 2024, it would be illegal for me to fire them for voting for Joe Biden. So, I mean, employers would have to, but I think it's a good law. Nevertheless, because they'll say, oh, well, this takes away the rights of employers to do this, that, and the other thing. No, it doesn't. It shows that we mean what we say
right.
when it comes to the Constitution, and that when it comes to work, and I'm an employer. I don't own my employees. I pay them for their time. And what my employees do off the clock, outside of work hours, is none of my daggone business. Now, if they were showing up to work drunk, which none of my employees do or something, yeah, then we'd have to talk about that. But it doesn't matter to me what my employees do outside of work hours, and it shouldn't. We're not slaves. We're not property of the companies we work for. And I think that's something that could even maybe get broad support if someone in the legislature had the cojones to do something like that. And it would neuter Antifa. They would be rendered, doxing would be rendered obsolete because the employers would be like, all right, I don't like this, but it's illegal for me to do anything about it.
My hands are tied.
Are tied. The law says I can't do this. Now, David, I believe you're licensed in California. I think California actually has some laws like that, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. In fact, I'm drafting a model anti-dox code for the Homeland Institute. Because one more thing is going to be proposing model legislation, and I actually researched this law in depth because I was doxxed. And so I decided to basically lawyer up in case I had problems with school. Nothing really came of it. But I think that this would be huge. So the California law, it's Cal Labor Code, section 1101 is sequential, if I recall. It actually is a little bit stronger than what you said, because it also applies to political activities and beliefs also on the clock. And so also they're not allowed to chill public participation. I forget the exact verbiage, but it's actually a little bit tougher. The only problem is that people don't stand by their rights and litigate it. There's not enough attorneys. People are all scared. And I think I feel like recently there's been a change where people just don't care about doxing anymore. It's not gone, but it's less of a thing. It's not like 2016.
Here's why, David. Because I'll say this. I don't want to talk about this case, but there was a guy out there calling me a Nazi and everything else under the sun in 2018. He got me fired from two jobs in a 12-month period. And after the second time, I did sue him. And the reason is because an example needed to be made. Because whether it was him or other people, I needed to show people that there was going to be some retribution if this activity continued. Now, this was in 2018, and it happened maybe 6 months after Charlottesville. And here's where the left kind of put themselves out of business here, okay? It has to do with the word Nazi. It's a word that everyone used. Now, after Charlottesville, I would suggest that the word Nazi meant something a lot different from what it means today, what it would mean in the common lexicon today. And that's the problem with defamation things against when we're using them against Antifa, because when you're doing a defamation thing, it's really like trying to hit a clay pigeon with a pistol. It's possible, but it's hard to do because the language is always a moving target. And what I tell people, I get activists that come to me wanting to do defamation cases all the time. And one of the criteria for a defamation case is they have to have said something that is a statement of fact. Now, let's talk about the word Nazi for a minute. If we went to Times Square in New York and found 100 random people and we asked them what a Nazi was, David and Greg, what percentage of those people do you think would say someone that voted for Donald Trump? What percentage? Ballpark it.
Oh, I'd say 70% in Times Square at least.
It's New York, so I'd say like maybe up to 75 to 80%. They're crazy.
Then if we went into other parts of the country, it would probably be between 30 and 50%, depending on where we went in the country, would say something like that. But, and so what the definition of Nazi has become based on its extraordinary overuse by the left, and this has been going on forever. I remember during the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, I remember people calling George W. Bush a Nazi. I mean, but it's gotten so prevalent and they've used the word so much that the word Nazi has become nothing more than a general political pejorative. It is without meaning. Nobody agrees on what it means. It's most often used in the common lexicon for something so divorced from its literal meaning that it can't be considered a statement of fact. And that's why doxing has lost its power. And that's a good thing, because they spent so much time in 2020 saying Trump is a Nazi, Trump is a fascist, MAGA is a fascist movement. When these Antifa call up employers and say, do you know you have a fascist, or you know you have a Nazi working for you? I mean, these employers are like, yeah, okay, someone voted for Trump that worked for me. Thank you for your call. We've got real work to do. Click. And that's why doxing has become less effective, because they've overplayed their hand with respect to the political vocabulary.
They're white supremacists because they like Candace Owens.
Yeah, that's hilarious. I want to circle back to the question about Antifa working with police, because it seems to me very, very plausible that although Antifa hate police, very large percentages of Antifa probably are police informants, for the simple reason that very large percentages of Antifa are drug addicts. And if Antifa are arrested smashing windows and, you know, overturning trash cans and things like that, and they are routinely arrested for doing that, they go to jail and they're held and they're forced to detox from whatever substance they're addicted to. Now, people with substance abuse problems being forcibly detoxed are extremely pliable towards being turned into informants. And so it strikes me as very plausible that a lot of Antifa are de facto police informants. And that means that police can gather information through these people that they could not legally gain on their own, and that this could be stovepiped into the offices of district attorneys who are preparing criminal cases. And so the whole system strikes me as extremely likely to be full of that kind of cozy corruption between these ostensibly opposed forces.
I'm not sure if I agree with you there, Greg. First of all, when we say that most anti-fascists are drug addicts and that they're on something, I think we need to be very careful with that, because I think that that's an assumption we make based off of their behavior. We look at the way these people behave, And no, and rational people don't behave in this manner. So it's very easy to assume that they're on drugs. If we assume that anti-fascists are on drugs, that's a powerful assumption to make. And it ultimately causes us to underestimate them. What I've learned about these people is that they're not to be underestimated. They're to be taken seriously. And, and not all of them are the pot smokers that sit in their mother's basement that we take them for. I think they're a lot more sophisticated than we like to give them credit for. I think they've got very good OPSEC, and that's because a lot of them, their whole purpose is getting past the OPSEC that exists on the dissident right. Now, that having been said, I also think we need to make a distinction between the Antifa we see on the streets, meaning the guys that are dressed in black block and that go around pepper spraying people, beating up little old ladies coming out of Trump rallies and stuff like that, because you've got that level of Antifa. And then you've got the more professional Antifa, the people like, for example, that are in charge of the district attorney's office in Charlottesville, Virginia right now, who have campaigns that were funded by George Soros. These aren't the people who are out burning dumpsters on the streets. These are anti-fascists who are academics, they're educated people, and they're taking over positions in government and bringing the principles of Antifa down to bear on the people. And here's what needs to happen. The anti-fascists in government, they need to be defeated at the polls. They need to be exposed. Their anti-fascist backgrounds need to be demonstrated to the people. They need to be shown they're not doing their job. Who's funding them needs to expose. They need to be defeated at the ballot box. That's the only way we're going to be able to get rid of those people. The anti-fascists on the streets who are assaulting people, I think the right has something to learn from this. We need to start finding out who these people are, turning information over to law enforcement, and demanding action. And if district attorney's offices are saying, oh, well, we're not going to prosecute them, well, I believe that the political process can work. We need to hound these district attorneys who aren't prosecuting anti-fascists. We need to be writing well-written letters to editors and articles and things like that, explaining that either these police officers or these prosecutors are not following the law, or they are applying the law to one group and not the other group, kind of like a Rob Rundo situation. Judge Carney, I'm not involved in the case, but I've been following it. Judge Carney in the California Federal District Court had dismissed the cases against Mr. Rundo based on selective prosecution by the government. I didn't read the whole thing, but the gist of it was he noted that the government targeted the right, but let Antifa run rampant at these things. So we on the right need to be doing our part to utilize the legal process to really, we can't compel them to take action, but let them know that if they don't, that there's going to be consequences at the ballot box. We need people who, even if they're not part of the right, they're at least going to apply the law equally running. And these people need to be defeated, because like these George Soros funded prosecutors in Charlottesville, they're as much Antifa to me as the guys in black block on the streets setting up dumpster fires.
Exactly.
Yeah, Antifa has really worn out their welcome recently, it seems. And I can say as a recent graduate of law school that law school is infested with these people. Even at Chapman University at Orange, where I went to, where it had what I would consider an ill-deserved conservative reputation. That was where Mr. John Eastman, who's one of Trump's lawyers, used to teach until they stabbed him viciously after January 6th for exercising his freedom of speech. Because why not? But yeah, I know one classmate who actually worked with Eugene Antifa, because I caught her following Eugene Antifa on Twitter, and I also had an anonymous tip off from an email. And so I know exactly who this person is. I won't say her name, but I might use that against her one day and pursue some legal action. I know who that nasty hoe is, and trust me, she's a nasty hoe. there are some other people out there who I know who just, you know, they were very casual about this. And, you know, I'm very quiet. I'm an ex-Intel guy. I pick up all this Intel, quietly collecting on them. I have dossiers on people. That might come back to haunt them one day. I know who these people are. They are disgusting people, and they've slithered into the system. And a lot of them are these crazy women on SSRIs. They fit the bill. And they're just out of control. But it's true. There's a suit and boot dichotomy in Antifa, and I think the suits are the more dangerous ones. Yeah. Like National Lawyers Guild, the little stupid lime green hats, those are all basically Antifa who went to law school. Those are the smart ones. Yeah. And they're all playing patty cake with the nasty ones that you don't see behind the scenes.
I remember there was a lawyer who works for the SPLC who was arrested in an Antifa demonstration, a riot basically, in Atlanta last year. So they do have some overlap with one another, definitely.
I'm not saying there's no overlap. I just think we have to distinguish between the two types of Antifa. We don't want to underestimate them because, like David was saying, we've got the suits and we got the boots.
Yeah.
Yeah. Another quick story, if you want it, I'll make a quick ad. My friend Ryan Sanchez, he runs the Nationalist Network, formerly known as Culture War Criminal. He ran the Orange County Antifa chapter and basically studied these people. He was undercover, and one of the things that he found was that some of these people were UC Irvine professors. So there's definitely a suit and boot. These people are playing patty cake and working with each other. So it's very strange. Some of these people are obese women who have trouble climbing, and some of them are full-on high-ranking professors at UC Irvine.
Interesting. Jason, I know you got to wrap up soon. I wanted to ask you a question. There are other lawyers out there who share your desire to defend the First Amendment rights of persecuted groups like Patriot Front. Is there any point in trying to network with these people and create some kind of national organization that would allow, for instance, them to get referrals if they're being persecuted in the state of Virginia, for instance? Is there anything like that? Is it informal? Could there be something more formalized? What's the state of networking, I guess, for pro First Amendment lawyers for the dissident right?
Well, the state of it, it's really a bit of a mess. I'm sure there's more, but I'm one of about 15 in the country I know of that's willing to do this type of work, because, and the reason I'm willing to do this type of work is because everything bad about me that could possibly be said has been said already. So there's really nothing else anyone can say about me anymore. So I might as well enjoy myself. But we don't have a lot of them, and the licensing structure for attorneys obviously makes it a lot more difficult to do this. Here's what needs to happen. I think the dissident right, it's getting, I don't want to say older, we'll say wiser. And but you know, I've noticed a trend where people are saying, oh, we don't want our young people going to college because they're going to be exposed to these anti-fascists. I disagree with that. I think we need young people who are on the right to be going to college and going to law school so that there are lawyers ready to fight. Because I'll tell you what, when I turn, I'm not going to be doing this when I'm, well, I might do it when I'm 80. It's kind of too much fun to leave behind. Hopefully I won't have to by the time I'm then. But, you know, I want to go hunting and fishing every day when I turn 80. I hope I'm not still having to do this type of stuff by then. So we need more lawyers in a variety of states that are willing to take on this type of work and know that it's hard. The money certainly isn't great, and people will hammer you harder representing the dissident right than they will if you represent child molesters, because everyone kind of understands that people who are accused of being child molesters, that the law says that they're entitled to an attorney. But boy, you start representing a guy that's accused of being a Nazi, they will write articles about you. And I've kind of found my center in that regard. I make it very clear to people, I represent the dissident right, but that's not that's actually a very small subset of my client base. I will represent anyone who needs an attorney who I think I can help. I don't discriminate at all in my practice. I take court-appointed work. I've got all people of all colors that I represent, and I work just as hard for all of them. But the reason for taking this work is because it's that important. Not many people are willing to do that. And if we don't have lawyers willing to take this work, we're not just fighting for the First Amendment rights of the dissident right. We're fighting for everybody's First Amendment rights. And what I tell people that don't like that I'm taking these cases is what you need to understand is that if the Ku Klux Klan, if the Aryan Freedom Network, if Patriot Front, if the Proud Boys, if none of them have First Amendment rights, well, then guess what? Neither do you. If they can strip these groups of their First Amendment rights, they can just as easily strip you of your First Amendment rights. And this is stuff that we need attorneys out there to help nip this in the bud, whether they're a part of the dissident right or not. I don't really care. I'll work with anybody as long as they're willing to say, we stand against this type of suppression of free speech in this country, because whether we agree with it or not, it really doesn't matter. I am very much personally opposed to abortion, but if there was a pro-abortion group in Texas that wanted me to fight for their right to demonstrate in front of the courthouse in favor of abortion, and the state was telling them they couldn't do that because of their pro-abortion message, you're darn right I would take their case, because they have free speech rights too. And we really need to get back to understanding that as a country. It's so important.
I totally agree. We got to work together. And I was wondering, do you think that given the persecution that both the dissident right and more normie conservatives are facing, do you think that eventually we'll be able to work more with them? Because at the end of the day, they treated my former constitutional law professor, John Eastman, just like me. He became persona non grata for being MAGA. Like, basically, MAGA is treated like scarcely any better than the dissident right at this point, it seems, at least in certain circles. So I'm wondering if a silver lining to all the problems we have is that we will be able to build bridges with the normal, generic conservatives, because we're both being persecuted, we have similar problems, and we're treated just the same way.
Well, I think the dissident right is a lot more correct in their behavior towards what I guess we'd call the normie conservatives, the MAGA folks. What needs to happen first of all is two things. One, the MAGA conservatives need to stop being the cult of Donald Trump. I like Donald Trump. He's going to be the nominee. I'm going to vote for him in November. And that's fine. But if MAGA means anything, it needs to actually be about making America great and not about one man. I think Trump's great, but they can't get past Trump, and that's going to cost them in the long run. And the other thing they need to do that just needs to stop is, you see it on Twitter all the time, any type of dissident right group goes out to protest, oh, those guys are feds. That's a Fed psyop and stuff like that. It's completely absurd. I mean, let's squash the rumors right now. First of all, if Patriot Front was a federal operation, I wouldn't be their attorney, because they would have attorneys at the Department of Justice representing them. And if the DOJ was contracting out, believe me, I'd be making a lot more money. So these groups are not Fed operations. They're not Fed psyops. And the whole thing reminds me of a South Park episode about 9/11, that if anything is a psyop, it's the notion that the federal government is running all of these psyops, because these people are being so stupid that they believe that there's this all-powerful FBI that's running, got these conspiracies and running these psyops all over the place. When the fact of the matter is, the most rational explanation to a group like Patriot Front is that these are good young American kids who are very concerned about the way that the direction of this country is going, and they're expressing that in a manner consistent with the law and the First Amendment. But oh no, they can't say that. Oh, they're covering their face. They're doing it because they're feds. Look at them. They look like they just got out of Quantico. I mean, they're actually saying, oh, if these people, if they don't have a bunch of people in their group who are morbidly obese, they must be feds. It's lunacy. I mean, so
it's a cell phone too.
This Fed jacketing, it's so annoying. It's so stupid. And where's the learning there? I mean, it's very easy. It's extremely easy to write someone off. Oh, they must be feds and just do that. But it's the most intellectually lazy thing you could possibly do. It's retarded. And I'm sorry, but that needs to stop. And once the normie right sees that the dissident right, that they might not agree on a lot of things, and that's okay. But we are not enemies. We're fighting a common enemy in many, many respects. And that only then, once they see that we're not that both sides see these other folks aren't the enemy, then we can probably make some progress on some of these issues and find some common ground. We'll never agree completely, but that's okay. Just because we don't agree completely doesn't mean we have to hate each other.
Yeah, that's really well said. Jason, do we have time to take one or two questions from the audience, or do you have to wrap up?
I've got about 10 minutes. Let's take some questions.
Okay, folks, if you have some questions out there, I'm just looking at Entropy. First of all, you can go to Entropy and leave a question. Archie has left a $5 donation, and he just has the comment, show me the man and I'll find you the crime. Also, $3 donation. Thank you. He says KKK torch marches can be preceded by trigger warnings to prepare the snowflakes that would steal their hurdy feelings. Just a joke. Yeah, let's see if there are some questions here, too, in our Odyssey stream. You can send Odyssey tips as well, and we appreciate that. I am not seeing anything here in Odyssey. Let's try DLive. Folks, you can send your diamonds, lemons, and ninjaginis our way if you'd like to help out. Leroy writes in, and he has a good question. He says, what is your advice for prospective law students?
Thank you for that question, Leroy. I want to help you out. I'm not sure where you're at right now, but here's the thing. One, if you're still an undergraduate and you're looking to go to undergraduate school and thinking about a choice of major, don't count out business programs. I didn't take a business level degree when I was an undergrad. I was essentially a political science major. And so if I didn't want to starve, all I could really do with that was go to law school. And so you want to have an undergraduate degree that's not only going to prepare you for law school, but that's going to prepare you for the fact that you're likely going to be running or help your own business or helping someone else to run a small business when you get out on your own. I would definitely consider being an accounting and economics or some other business major. While at the same time, if your school offers a minor and you can take electives, take classes that are going to teach you how to write well and learn some legal text. Some undergraduate courses do have like a constitutional law or classes about the judiciary. I didn't really think those were helpful to me. I took a history class called the Constitutional and Legal History of Medieval England when I was an undergrad. It was absolutely fascinating and had me reading some really old texts. Some classes on like ancient philosophy where you're reading Plato, or Christian philosophy where you're reading like St. Thomas Aquinas. You want to be able, you're going to need to know how to read a complicated text and how to analyze it and write well. That's going to set you up for success in law school. But, you know, some people get to law school and it's not for them. So you have your business degree to fall back on. And additionally, some law schools offer a joint JD MBA program, so you can get two degrees for almost the price of one at that law school and have the tools in place to help you run a successful firm when you get out and you're not making the mistake I did and you end up having to learn all about running a business through the school of hard knocks because you took a liberal arts major as an undergrad. So that's what the advice I'd give you. And then when you get to law school, you know, learn about time management. Definitely take some time for yourself. Else you're gonna burn out. And take opportunities to do work for other lawyers as much as you can, because unless you've got a really good trial ad program, it's doing work for actual lawyers, helping them write briefs and motions. They're going to be the ones that really show you how to practice law and what really goes into it. That's going to help you out a lot. Maybe look at being a process server while you're a law student. That's what I did. You'll learn all about serving papers, and that's going to help you. I know it's helped me in my career. So those are all things I would definitely look at. And if you find me on Twitter and slide into my DMs, I'm happy to expound further so I can answer one or two more questions.
That's a great answer. I have one more question here. This is from Elaine. Most politicians were lawyers at one time. Have you ever considered running for office?
Yes, I have considered running for office. I have no desire to be in the federal legislature to run for federal office or really any legislative office, because I don't think the system is working for the people right now. If I were to run for office, I would be looking at running for an office in the judiciary, maybe be a county or a district judge, because I think I could bring some. I mean, like I said, and at the state level, it wouldn't even be about this, but I think I could call a fair game in both criminal and civil trials. I also think society's become too focused on punishment, which, while it is undoubtedly needed for some offenses, there are people out there, I've learned as a criminal defense lawyer, who can be rehabilitated. And I think we've got very good judges where I live, but I think there needs to be more opportunities for people who make mistakes to truly become rehabilitated and be able to put their mistakes or their past behind them. That's going to be better for the person, and it's going to be better for society. Yeah, there's always people you're going to need to lock up, but I've actually become a more tolerant person and a bigger believer in second chances by doing criminal defense. I know that's not the most conservative position, but I think it's an important one.
I can back you up on that. A lot of prosecutors are pursuing quantity of convictions over quality. And once you see how they are, it's like you do get they are frankly out of control sometimes.
Yeah, you've got prosecutors who say, if prison's not the answer, then it must have been a stupid question. And that just couldn't be more wrong. In Denton County, where I practice, we've got a drug court program run by the Honorable Judge Burgess. I've seen great success out of the program. Judge Waddell in Denton County, I believe he's still running the mental health court and the DWI court programs. I've seen great results, lives saved and turned around by those programs. I think Judge Beadle in Denton County runs the Veterans Court program. Again, a great program for these people. And for people that take them seriously, they work. They say, I think these specialty courts and these pretrial diversion programs for a lot of offenses, I think they save lives.
Well, Jason, thank you so much. You've given us a lot of your time. And as a lawyer, you're well paid for it. So we very much appreciate it. How do people follow your work? You have a presence on Twitter, and of course, you're practicing law in the state of Texas. Do you have any other platforms out there where people can see you?
You can follow me on Twitter at @AttorneyJLVD. I've got an Instagram. I don't add anyone, but Facebook's more for me to stay in touch with old friends. I don't add people I don't know on my Facebook, but I've got Instagram. I've got a Getter that I never check. You can follow me on LinkedIn. Twitter for me, it's my opportunity to troll people. So I like to have a little bit of fun with it, but I will post updates on cases, and I will comment on various legal issues that I find interesting on my Twitter. So Twitter's probably the best place to follow me, at AttorneyJLVD on Twitter.
Well, thank you so much. I would like to thank you for joining us, David, for co-hosting. I want to thank all of our listeners out there, our moderators, the people who've donated. We will be back next week with another episode of Countercurrents Radio. The guest is yet to be determined. Early next month, we are going to have our fourth episode of our book club. That'll be on my book, Against Imperialism. So in the meantime, keep reading Countercurrents. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.